Advanced Bird Language, Reading the Concentric Rings of Nature with John Young.
Well, I'm glad we're all here to talk about bird language. It's definitely one of my passions. And I think that when I look at what bird language means, it's such an invisible world. It's like the world of tracking. There's people who look at footprints and have an idea what they think tracking might be. But it's not until they run into the likes of Tom Brown and really hear what tracking is that they realize there's a whole universe. Bird language is a lot like that. We can skim the surface and kind of give people a hint about it, but it's not until we dive in a little bit that we really begin to appreciate what's possible. So it's going to be fun for us to spend these six recording sessions together and to work through this information, and I know there'll be enough in here to last a lifetime for all of us to really explore and learn about birds on our own. There's been a lot of people that have lived on this planet who have gotten to know bird language to a very high degree. In some places, it was sort of randomly assimilated into the culture, and there wasn't really a sophisticated language around it. In other places, it became highly developed. And in the same way that through Tom Brown, from his mentor Stalking Wolf, the whole idea of pressure release studies, detailed understanding of how to read information in tracks, evolved just among that one tribe of people, similar to the way acupuncture evolved into a whole system of understanding of things that would otherwise seem invisible. So we're going to do something similar with bird language. We're going to take ideas and concepts that have always been intuitive to native hunter-gatherers and really bring them to the surface to give people what you might call a pathway to walk on, things to measure their progress by, things to know. This is what I need to learn if I want to take this really far. So I'm excited about this, and I can remember since childhood it seems maybe I was meant to do this and to share this knowledge. Since I was a very small kid, long before I met Tom Brown, who became my tracking mentor, I used to hear stories of bird language from my great aunt, Carrie, who came over from Poland as a little girl. She always talked about her mother, Grandma Novak, and how Grandma Novak had this very special relationship with a robin that lived in her yard, and how the robin would always come and talk to her, and she would say a certain poem in Polish that I don't know, and touch her finger to her palm, and that robin would come right up and touch its beak to her fingertip. And I heard that story over and over and over as a child, and that's the power of stories, how they really get into you. You begin to really begin to program your awareness according to the stories you hear. And that was one of my earliest stories. That one and other stories that my great aunt Carrie shared with me about how the birds brought her messages and told her things. And I heard that all through my childhood. And when I met Tom, he had a whole nother take on bird language that went a whole lot deeper, much more sophisticated. But at that point, I had already been watching and listening to the birds to a pretty good degree. When I was probably maybe 7 or 8, I remember the bird called the yellow-shafted flicker and how it would call from the swamps by my mother's house. I would hear the voice of that bird, and it reminded me of a jungle bird that I had heard on the soundtrack of, I think the show was called Doctari on television, but that bird used to call from the swamp, and I'd hear it, and right away I would click into this sense of adventure, and I would go off in search of it. It wasn't until I was 15 that I finally actually found out who was making that call in a whole different place and a whole other set of circumstances, but I followed that bird more times than I can tell you, and it always led me to really interesting adventures. As I got to know the flicker through the years, and in my adult years, I began to find out that it had a lot of symbolic meaning to Native people in this country. I was given a gift of a flicker feather by a Native elder in Utah while I was traveling with Tom one summer, about 1978, and I began to understand that flickers had some powerful significance in Native tradition and storytelling on this continent. So I've come to watch birds not only for the language that they share through their voices and just trying to live and to stay alive and to communicate to their families, which is basically what they're doing. Beyond that information, which is rich, there's also lots of lore and symbolic meaning to bird language that enriches life as well. Flickers are like that for me. Anytime a flicker flies over or calls, I always have to pause and think for a moment, symbolically, a little deeper below the surface. The other day, I was in New York State in Cherry Valley at Hawk Circle teaching advanced coyote teaching, and we were standing outside during one of the breaks when five flickers flew over me, one right behind the other in single file, and landed on a big sugar maple in front of me. And I couldn't help but pause and say, wow, this is quite a message. And I watched those five flickers for a little while, and I thought to myself, what is it that we're talking about right now in that class, and what important message can I bring? And the idea of the knowledge of mankind is what came to me. A concept that comes from traditional teachings of the Lakota people, the reference to the power of the East. What does the power of the East symbolically represent in their culture? You might look at it as a curriculum or a set of learning goals. And if we think back 500 years to when these people were hunter-gatherer nomads, the knowledge of mankind had a whole different meaning than it does today, and that's real important for us to stop and think about before we get too deep into the subject of bird language. Knowledge of the human beings to a hunter-gatherer tribe is the knowledge of place. It's the knowledge of every aspect of the environment. It's knowledge of the plants and how they grow and how they change through the seasons, over the years. It's the knowledge of ecology. It's the knowledge of the animals and how they relate to the plants and the plant communities. And it's about how we as people wander that landscape, how we have to focus on certain aspects of it in order to live. If we don't learn of our place deeply enough, we can't survive and pass knowledge on to the next generation. So before the coming of modern lifestyles and supermarkets and the kinds of things that we all take for granted and depend upon now, all of our ancestors once had very sophisticated knowledge of place that was reflected in the way their brains developed. And bird language is a wonderful doorway into that whole understanding. I look at the knowledge of human beings, the power of the East, our goal as people trying to learn these ancient ways again, requires that we shift out of our modern mind for a little while and get into the mind of the hunter-gatherer to really appreciate the depth into which we can explore the subject, the language of the birds. So we'll come back to knowledge of human beings again towards the end of this tape. I wanted to start by telling a quick story, because I think people, when they hear about the language of the birds, they get really intimidated. And they're thinking, well, gosh, I can't even identify the birds that come to my feet, or how in the heck am I going to understand their language? That's way too much for me. So I look back to a time when I've always told people this, that when you go to a new place, like if I went to Africa or Australia, I would understand the language of the birds there just as well as I do here at my own secret spot. And that's because the language of the birds has little to do with the species. It has everything to do instead with what Mowgli might call jungle law. I like to call it jungle etiquette. So I was being introduced to a gym, I guess you could call it, a mentoring location in California run by the Rikers Center, and I was being escorted around by then board member Tony Moon to be introduced to all the different aspects of this program. He was showing me the different workout rooms, and he was showing me photographs on the wall of Gary Rikers and all the people he's mentored over the years, and I was seeing football stars and different people, and Tony was going into great depth. And as you might, I want you to be Tony for a minute and just imagine yourself completely wrapped up in the excitement of showing somebody something that you know a lot about, you know, how your whole world becomes absorbed by that experience. And I've always been taught by Tom to remain detached and to be paying attention to many things at once and not to get too wrapped up in any moment, because you never know when some important information is coming at you from a different place, you know. So it's important to be able to listen to both things at the same time. And that's, people know how to do that. People multitask all the time. I see them driving in their cars, talking on their cell phones, putting on eye makeup all at once while drinking their coffee. So We all understand multitasking. I'm just talking about doing it with our awareness. So as I was walking with Tony through this house, we got to this back room, and we looked through the sliding, well, he didn't actually. I was looking through the sliding glass door at a curious little brown bird that was hovering at the window, picking something out of the spider webs there. And I kept getting closer and closer to see what it was, and I finally figured out that it was actually eating baby spiders with this, its long, curved, almost like tweezers for a beak. And it was a real curious little thing. It reminded me of a wren, but it wasn't a wren. It had a really long tail. But I observed that it was dark brown, and from what I know about bird language, I know that birds that are dark brown like to be near the earth. That's where they go when they're unsure of things. They go and hide near the earth. That's their coloration, their background. So I decided to get a little bit closer to this bird. In the meantime, Tony's hands are waving around, and he's pointing at this feature and that feature and talking some more, and he hasn't yet noticed that bird. And he might have noticed me noticing something, but I'm always noticing something, so he has learned to ignore me. And at this point, I get my face kind of close to the sliding glass door, just close enough that this little brown bird becomes startled by my face, and it immediately goes down to the ground to the base of the overgrown hedges that are growing right outside the sliding glass door. So the hedges go right past the top of the sliding glass door. And so I make note of that fact, that that bird did indeed go down to the ground for safety. And I'm continuing to listen to Tony, and I'm watching that bird, and then I kind of look up over my shoulder, like out the sliding glass door this way to the left of the hedges, and I can see a robin singing on a tree branch that's out over the lap pool, which is Tony is now talking about. He's saying, here's the lap pool, and you know, this is where you can go and swim laps. It's got its own current, you know, so you don't have to turn around and go the other way. I was like, oh, that's neat. So watching this bird singing on the branch out there, it's a robin. I can't hear it singing, but its head is flipping this way and that way, and its mouth is open, you know, and you can see its throat moving, and its body language is saying, I'm very relaxed and peaceful. So I'm tuning into that. And now I'm back looking at the brown bird, which I found out when I got to a field guide later that day, it was actually called a wren tit. I was now watching the wren tit again, and it was down near the ground, when suddenly that wren tit flew up to a height just above waist height, maybe a little bit higher than waist height, right back towards my face again. So, you know, I was pretty close to the sliding glass door again looking at it, and it came right back to my face. And just remember, a couple minutes earlier, my face that close to it caused it to fly down. So all of a sudden, there was something more scary than me, right? That had a much more significant meaning to that bird than my face did, as ugly as it might be. Anyway, this bird flies up, lands on a branch, makes a sound that's audible through the sliding glass door. I could hear it, but I couldn't quite make it out. It sort of sounded like a chit sound like that. And it pumped its tail. And at that moment, out of the corner of my eye, I saw that robin do something really different. You know, it wasn't singing. It did a real startling movement, and I looked up at it. It had pumped its tail, and its body language went rigid, and it stopped singing. So I knew that whatever message that that bird was bringing was enough of a message, enough significance that the robin also paid attention to it. So here is a clear warning. And everybody at this point, I always ask the people in the audience when I tell this story to tell me what was coming. And everybody knows the answer. I've never yet met an audience of people who don't know that that is a cat coming, right? That's how easy bird language is once you tune into it. So putting two and two together, what else could be possibly coming into a suburban backyard that would scare this bird? And that bird went up to that certain height. And by the way, birds only go high enough. They never go higher than they need to. So this cat has been around this corner before, shall we say. And all of a sudden, I said to Tony, hey, there's a cat coming, look. And of course, he's in the middle of telling that story. He's so absorbed in that story. That comment I made must have come out of left field for him, because he paused and looked at me for a second, got a blank look on his face, and said, what? I said, there's a cat coming, look. And I pointed at the place on the ground where the cat would appear. And just then, he turns and looks with this really kind of faraway look in his eye, and trains his eyes down in that place just in time for this house cat to appear and come around the corner and run right past the base of the sliding glass window. And his jaw literally just went slack. His mouth hung open for a second, and he just looked at me. And the look on his face was great. It was like, you know, almost like I must be psychic or, you know, have some kind of strange powers, you know, but it was nothing more than just putting two and two together in the context of common sense and observation. So you can see, and you all knew that it was a cat too. So that's a, you know, an example of how bird language works. So if you're thinking, gosh, you have to get to know the birds and all this information on their species and their order and all that, you don't really need to. It's more a matter of understanding the basic principles. And I think all the stories that I've gathered to put into this tape series has enough kind of role modeling stories that you'll be able to put two and two together, and I'll give you a lot of tools to work through that. So what I'd like to do is give you a quick review of what it is that we're going to do in this six tape series and then get down to it. My plan is to do an overview and orientation through hero stories. So who has successfully learned bird language and why? That will appear throughout the whole series. I've decided that having stories that illustrate throughout the whole tape series would be a good way to keep them interesting while you're learning good skills. And orientate you a little bit about what bird language is, where it comes from. Tell you success stories, who's learned it successfully. And then also some detail, how to go about and learn the birds. And this is based on my last 3 years of experience in a focused manner, training local students in Washington State every Thursday in bird language classes, actually taking them through step by step this method and telling you some of the successes of the more advanced students, what they've been able to do with that. So you'll be able to actually just learn from their successes and as well as their challenges. And then the next thing we're going to do is profile progressions of awareness. And these are what I would call tools for self-direction. So you'll be able to say, well, where am I at in my knowledge of bird language? Because what goes on with bird language is more than just knowledge. This knowledge actually gets inside of you and changes the way you are as well. It's not a one-way street. It's not like learning math where you take in the math knowledge and you use it at will and you don't have to change who you are. Bird language gets into you, causes you to see yourself very differently because birds will treat different people differently based on the kind of body language they put out, the kind of vibe that they put out. And I know we all know what vibes are about, and I usually don't have to tell, especially people like mothers, about vibes because they're very intuitive. They pick up energy from people. We know that certain people give you a certain feeling. Birds are really perceptive about that kind of stuff. And understanding, as soon as you realize that birds are reflecting back to you who you are, that becomes a point of discomfort for a lot of people. They will immediately start to adjust who they are based on what the birds are saying. So we'll talk about what we might call the symptoms of awareness as you grow as someone who understands these skills. You know, we call it the Homer Simpson to stalking wolf progression. You know, there's a continuum of awareness that goes from, on the one hand, somebody who's never set foot outdoors and doesn't believe there is bird language, to the other extreme, the ancient scouts who not only understood bird language, but who could completely hide from it and actually alter the landscape using really intense psychological methods. And we call it, Tom talks about that in his book, The Vision, and that is learning to walk in the veils, quote unquote. So then we talk in the fourth part of this series about bird language over time. These are progressions of advanced experience. So in the beginning, what do you expect? When you first go out and sit around under that tree that you're going to be adopting and using all the time as your learning place, what are the first kinds of things you'll experience on your first day out there? And how does that change over minutes? And then how does it change over the seasons? How are birds different times of day? And then how over the next months or years will bird language change in terms of your experience? So it's another form of profiling, but it's really looking at it from the bird's point of view this time. Then we'll talk about ancient lore and tradition of bird language. We'll talk about native people's perspectives on this. We'll talk about the way Stalking Wolf mentored Tom Brown to understand this and the way Tom mentored me to understand this. And I think if I can tell you a little bit about my history, specifically how I learned birds, you might say, oh, well, he's saying one thing on his tapes, but this is how he did it. Well, then you have the choice to choose between those two methods. I'm going to say that I learned it a lot slower than you could learn it. You know, I learned it over 7 years going to my secret spot every day. And I've seen people reach the same skill level within 2.5 years, 3 years. So that's the community school method that I'm going to be sharing in the second part of the series. So basically, my mistakes, you don't have to repeat them, but I'm going to offer them to you anyway in case you want to. And then the sixth part of this, I'm going to be talking about how bird language, understanding it, and when you really get into it and get grounded in it, how it will change your sensory awareness abilities, how that will influence the way your brain develops, and how that will result in what I call quote-unquote spiritual development. And the reason I say quote-unquote is because I'm not a great believer that spirituality is somehow separate from this whole process. I think spirituality is just a form of sensory awareness that people have taken out of context and turned into religions over time or meditative practices, where in a native hunter-gatherer situation, those things are seen as everyday sensory experience. They're not really interpreted out as something that needs to be separated. So we'll talk about some of that, the implications of that. And then what I like to call symptoms of awareness, what happens when your brain becomes fully patterned like a hunter-gatherer? How will you know you've arrived there? Because there won't be like a college to give you a degree in it. There's some really fun stuff which I've derived from working with Gilbert Walking Bull, the seven sacred aspects of brain patterning, I like to call it. And then we'll close with some concepts directly from Stalking Wolf about brain patterning, awareness, and spirituality that are very ideal to this to the context of this subject here. So that's what I see doing with this program. And also that you know that this tape series will live within Wilderness Awareness School's independent study programs as a module or a plug-in to the independent studies line. And if you're really interested in pursuing this, I have to recommend to everybody, as I always have, just sign up for Independent Studies Level 1 to get started, because it'll teach you all the basic routines you need to know about how to get busy in your own area. And by the time you've been through Independent Studies Level 2, you might then be able to consider this option, exploring bird language as your focus. Some people will go into tracking, others will go into knowledge of survival skills. But this is all designed to help you in your backyard move along in a way that feels like you're actually making some progress. And that's what Wilderness Awareness School is here for, to help people along the way. So let's really get started here. So I like to I looked at an example from my everyday life of exactly what's possible. And I don't want to mention any names because I don't want to embarrass anybody. So I like to observe people who practice these things and watch what they're capable of. And what seems to be random is not random at all. At first, it seems to be random. And I know that the people who observe this wish it was random. But it's not. It really has to do with practice. And I'm watching one of the senior apprentices who's really good at bird language, who studied in the community school for 3 years, just kind of walk around, do her secret spot routine, and come back and report to me what she's been seeing. And in the last few days, she's seen a mink traveling with its babies, and she watched it make tracks along the edge of the water. She's watched a weasel up close and personal on several occasions recently. And then there's some other people that are around at this time who are real interested in learning this stuff and whose profession it is to work with this information, who has never seen a mink or a weasel and has been out in the woods over and over and over again. And it would seem like somebody's being lucky and someone else is not, but it has absolutely nothing to do with luck. It has everything to do with the kind of profile that the person who has spent 3 years at her secret spot has versus the person who hasn't. And, you know, why is that happening? Well, there's so many subtle nuances of language and bird language and behavior that are going on around you all the time. We don't really think of it because we're not involved in the bird's world enough to really think, is this a reflection of who I am or not? When the birds are out there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, fighting for their life, essentially, having to raise a family, having to constantly keep on the guard for numerous different kinds of predators that live in their environment, some of which make our Friday the 13th hero, Jason, you know, look mild, really, literally. You know, when you consider a sharp-shinned hawk trying to feed its teenagers and all it feeds it is songbirds, then you know that that sharp-shinned hawk is killing a lot of songbirds. So which basically means that we worry about serial killers in our parks in the cities. Just imagine what a sharp-chinned hawk represents to that scene. You know, that it's a very real thing, and it's there all the time. It never goes away. There is constantly a killer out there ready to get these birds. So any bird who doesn't really take that in, internalize that, and make that part of their everyday experience, dies. Simple as that. The birds who don't have awareness are removed from the scene really quickly. We don't have that in our society today. There is no equivalent of that in our society, so we don't even know what that looks like. How could somebody be that aware that they would be reading around corners with their awareness? You know, we don't have to do that anymore. So for us, it's hard to imagine that that's even possible. But for the robin out there in the yard, that's not only possible, that's necessary. And the robin can't understand who we are. You know, how could you be walking around in such a fog without any awareness at all, maybe the robin is thinking. When you walk out the door, you're thinking about walking to your car or what you have to do or finding your keys in your pocket, and all these thoughts are going through your head. In the meantime, the robin's looking at you and profiling you, looking at you from the top of your head to the bottom of your feet, and in a microsecond is picking up all sorts of information about you that you don't even know you're broadcasting. And so when we think that it's random that one person has all these great close encounters with animals and another person doesn't, even though they want to, you know, you have to understand the difference between those people is really in what the birds are seeing, you know, and what the birds are reading in a microsecond based on not only body language, the way you carry yourself, but also the vibe that you put out and where you direct your eyes and attention. All that is read by the birds, and it means a lot to them. You know, they live by that. Remember, any animal that evolved to have plumage that's colorful, little tiny subtle field marks, little stripes on wings, little rings around eyes, all these little subtle field marks, right? They look at each other very carefully all the time. They study each other. They look at each other's bodies and they say, aha, that's what that one's thinking over there. And they look at coloration, they listen to voices, and they invest a lot in voices, vocalization. They sing, they have beautiful songs, but they also have a very expressive call language that has a lot of meaning to it. And because they're putting out all that information, they also have to listen with the same intensity. So we got to understand that there is a sophisticated language going on outside that the birds are tuning into. Okay, now, when I first moved to Washington in 1995, there was a place kind of near where I lived that had a male and a female wolf that had a couple of young ones that they were hiding in a cottonwood forest. And whenever I went there with other people, I wouldn't have any close encounters with those wolves. And I found that I couldn't even communicate to the people that I was walking with what was going on there. I noticed this, though, that when I walked by myself at that location, there would be a robin singing in a certain location there from the branch of an alder tree. And in the first light of dawn, I would be walking really quietly along the moss and sort of doing what I'll call the routine of invisibility. I was walking along in that manner, and I was able to walk right under that robin. And I remember one morning in the very, very early light of dawn, standing just a few feet beneath that robin as it was singing, so I could have reached up and touched its feet. You know, that's how close it was. And it never interrupted its song by my presence. And how important that is, because of what I've learned over the years, how the birds don't respond to me in the same way as they might respond to a beginner. So whenever I went to see the wolves, I'd have to go alone if I was going to have any success at all getting close to them. And I could get really close to them. I didn't necessarily see them all the time, but I knew where they were because of what the birds were telling me, and also by the freshness of the track and sign that they would leave. So the other thing I wanted to share with you is why I use the stories of other people's successes, because I think it's important that I don't focus so much on the great mastery of bird language of Stalking Wolf or of Tom Brown or myself even, but more on people who are kind of common everyday people who have success. I think it's important that you hear those stories throughout this whole series because it will remind you that you don't have to be raised by a tracker to do this. You just have to practice these skills. Okay, so We know this method is tried and true. We got the attention of an author who writes books on ninjas recently when he met the community school students during a scout workshop in Eastern Washington through Coyote Path Wilderness School. And he was very impressed with the ability of these young people and their ability to read the bird language. And it reminded him of a lot of the ninja teachings. And I thought that was a good compliment to sort of be recognized. So please know that this stuff does work. What is our goal out there? I really want you guys to be able to get really good at this. Why would we bother? I mean, in the old days, the reason for doing this was so that you could become a great hunter. And why would you want to become a great hunter? Well, because then you could feed your family. and not only that, but in a way, it became like a status symbol. You know, the more you could provide for your family, the more you rose in importance. And people love to be appreciated. And that holds true in Native tribes as well as in modern experience, that to have honor and respect as a great hunter was something of a carrot, you know, that drove people. And they became great providers. And when they were really good, they would not only feed their own families, but they would also feed the woman whose husband was killed in battle. And they would take care of feeding the elders in the community and looking after these children and all that sort of thing. So it was sort of the ultimate philanthropic gesture to become a great hunter. But in order to become a great hunter, you needed to really know this stuff that I'm sharing with you now. So that was the impetus for learning bird language in those days. Also, it really helped in the tribes like the Apaches, where one tribe was always attacking the other in a constant game of capture the flag that had a pretty high stakes outcome, that you had to have a scout society, that is, people who lived invisibly on the edge of your community, who watched for danger approaching. And they watched for it not only in visible signs of it, here comes a person, I better run back and tell people, but actually being able to tell 2 miles away that, for instance, the soldiers of the white armies were coming. They could tell by the bird behavior that that's what was going on. So it was really to their advantage also to have sophisticated knowledge of bird language. As well, they also had to be invisible, so they not only had to be able to know the bird language for what it told in terms of the approach of things or the movement of things in the environment, but they also had to invest in invisibility so the birds wouldn't give away their location, because the other scouts from the enemy tribe knew the bird language as well. So what about us? I'd like to call us the recreational bird language learners. You know, what is our investment in this? You know, why would we bother learning this? And it has to do with the thrill we get out of observing animals doing what they do. And if you're tired of only seeing foxes cross your headlights at night, you know, 100 yards away, or watch a coyote spot you and gallop off into the distance, you know, or see only does and fawns feeding at the edge of fields and never get to see the buck, or begin to think that there's only does living here, there are no bucks, bucks don't exist, you know, you begin to develop that impression. If you're like me, you probably would much rather see that fox lying on a mossy bed in dappled sunlight in the early morning, surrounded by a tapestry of bird song with the wind tickling the grasses, and watch that fox lazily licking its paws and, you know, grooming itself and just kind of looking out over the landscape with soft eyes. Being able to observe that fox when it's in its most relaxed state, watch its ears turn this way and that as it picks up and listens to the nuances of bird language around it. To really see the fox living in its world in a relaxed manner, that's the goal, you know, to be able to observe wildlife as if you weren't really even there. Because we begin to wonder, I think, if all we ever see is foxes running in the distance or never seeing them at all, do we actually begin to wonder if foxes only live by running from here to there all the time, you know? That's what I think you would have to start to conclude after a while, that all animals do is run from things, and or that animals don't really exist. So, you know, maybe this whole Marty Stopher thing on TV is really just a big farce. Animals don't ever relax, and they never actually live a normal life. How come Marty Stopher can get all this great footage of these animals doing this nice, relaxed, kickback stuff, you know, and we never get to see that? So, you know, my offer to the recreational bird language learners is, if you get really good at this, you'll be capable of seeing those, you know, award-winning wildlife shots out there while they're happening, as opposed to seeing things run away. So that's the carrot. you can meet any animal you want using these skills. Literally, you can combine your skills as a tracker with your skills as a bird language person and see the tracks of a very old mountain lion and say to yourself, aha, if I choose to see this animal with my own eyes, I can. And that's what bird language knowledge would give you the ability to do. And, you know, nature photography might become something that you get really good at as a result of this. I wouldn't be surprised if you got some front cover shots for National Wildlife as a result of this, you know, this experience. The other thing is, if you're a person who likes and practices survival skills, this is where it really comes home. You know, this is when you can actually, literally, if you had to hunt, you could get anything you wanted the same way, just like by observing the same difference. There's side effects. You will develop amazing instincts as a result of this. Amazing instincts. You'll see things beyond the surface, let's put it that way. And that little saying, a little bird told me, will begin to take on a whole different meaning to you as a result of studying bird language. And you won't be able to explain that to your relatives. You'll be like my Aunt Carrie was, considered by all the relatives to be a little bit out of her tree. You know, she was a little bit short of a picnic, one sandwich short of a picnic. Although I never found Aunt Carrie to be that way. You know, and in all honesty, I felt that of all the relatives, she was the only one who was at the picnic. The rest of them were still in the parking lot. So I guess it's all a matter of perspective. Maybe they call me one sandwich short of a picnic now. I've taken up for Aunt Carrie and the family. But you will develop amazing instincts. It will influence your ability to know things and not know how you know. The other aspect of this is that bird language will help you to know yourself in ways that nothing else could get you to know yourself. To truly know yourself under all circumstances. To know yourself under stress, under calmness. To really know when all the thoughts are stripped away, when all the fears are stripped away, who am I? What does it mean to be me? Bird language will teach you that in a really, really good way. It's a very, very nice, comforting way to learn who I am. And I guess that's probably because you'll be spending a lot of time alone. Or I should say, a lot of time without other people around. You won't ever be alone. The birds will certainly keep you company. Okay, so what else we're going to work on in this whole series is what we like to call the routine of invisibility. We'll be talking about animal forms. What are animal forms? They are kind of a modern version of native dance. And we look at it from very specific goals because it's not just movement, but also what we do with our minds that matter here. And we're going to kind of do a quick review of the pieces that are important in bird language that I laid down in Native Eyes Tape 6, The Language of the Birds, because there's important things in there that I covered kind of lightly that I'm going to want to dive a little deeper into in this series, because we really need depth here in order to get far in this. We'll talk about some surprising things, almost ironic things. After we learn all this stuff about bird language and the sensitivity of the alarm system, we'll start to find that it has some real chinks in it, some real Achilles heels. For instance, how running, you know, as a jogger, joggers tend to see more wildlife than those people who move around in a stealthy and quiet manner. Why is that? What's going on there? How come we can see animals while we're running? You know, it would seem like that's the opposite of what should happen. We'll figure out those kinds of things. You know, what are the chinks in the armor of bird language? We can look to at the concept of baseline. What, you know, when I described the fox to you just a little while ago, the fox licking its paws, you know, that whole scene, the whole feeling of that scene is what we call baseline. That whole idea is the cornerstone of learning bird language. But there's a sort of catch-22. Until you develop enough baseline within yourself from practice, you won't get to see what baseline really is. So in a way, what's going to happen with baseline is it's going to be an ever-shifting reality for you as you journey along your learning of the bird language skills. You think you know what bird language, you just think you know what baseline is, when all of a sudden it takes on a whole new character. That's because you're taking on a whole new character. So we'll talk about that. I think the more you know about that, the more you can anticipate it, the faster you can feed back to yourself, the faster you can change. So we're going to work on that. I will say this, that most people in the modern world today will never experience baseline because of the lifestyle they've chosen, because of the lifestyle that has chosen them, perhaps. It might be a better way to look at it. The high-stress life that we live, the amount of kinds of things that are always on our heads that we have to constantly consider, these things will prevent you from ever experiencing baseline. So we'll look at some of that, too. And, of course, that's going to have implications, you know, in terms of your philosophy of life. I know bird language is challenging to people, so we'll talk about some of that, too. How do we integrate this experience? Because sometimes it doesn't feel like it integrates very well at all back into modern life. We'll talk about energy conservation as a priority, and among the birds and animals, how that's so important. So we'll also talk about what we call the secret spot, or the sit area, if you're from the Tracker School classes. The sit area, the sacred area, the medicine area, whatever you want to call it, it's basically the place that you visit all the time. And we'll really develop that in detail within the context of bird language, because that is the backbone of your study. Okay, and then I have about, I don't know, a couple of dozen specific alarm stories that I'm going to share that will tell you how to understand and interpret bird language through the eyes of the weasel, through the eyes of the song sparrow, through the eyes of the fox, that sort of thing. And we'll talk about specific alarm sources and the specific behaviors of the birds themselves as sources of alarm information. And then we'll also talk about what we call non-bird alarms, miscellaneous bird behaviors, such things as chipmunks or frogs and what role they play in the whole story. And overall, I think you'll just get a sense that this is mostly just common sense applied to observation skills. And that's what really it comes down to. But as my wonderful mentor and the grandfather of Wilderness Awareness School says, common sense isn't so bloody common after all. Very few people have it anymore. So we'll understand what common sense is from that perspective as well. So that should get us started. If you after listening to this, you're not interested, well, then you probably shouldn't listen to any more. But if anything interested you from what you just heard, well, flip this tape over and we'll go for it.